day, and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've decided to join us today. It was 10 years ago today that Detroit made history when it became the largest U.S. city to ever file for bankruptcy. It was a profound low. A city once at the forefront of industry and innovation found itself facing an unparalleled fiscal crisis. And it was the inflection point for decades of external disinvestment and abandonment, as well as internal poor decision-making. The bankruptcy happened simply because there was no other workable option. The city had borrowed to pay for borrowing that was paying for other borrowing. $18 billion in liabilities. If the city had sold everything it owned, it still would have been two-thirds short of being able to pay its obligations. Detroit was the dictionary definition of broke, and it had been pushed there by rich histories of all of our ills: economic isolation, mismanagement and financial gamesmanship, racism, complacency. Ultimately, then Governor Rick Snyder decided it made no sense to continue without making some grand effort to turn things around. So he used a controversial law to appoint Kevin Orr as the city's emergency manager, a position where Orr controlled city finances without ever being elected to office and could go around every elected official in Detroit to do the things he thought needed to be done. Orr led the city to and through Chapter 9 municipal bankruptcy, a process that lasted more than a year and saw a massive restructuring of debt and the sale of some assets. The city shed $7 billion of that $18 billion in debt and emerged in much better position to spend its money providing services for the people who live here, rather than using almost all of its money to pay creditors. Today, there's no question, the finances of the city of Detroit are in much better shape than they were when the city entered bankruptcy a decade ago. But there are still real questions about what the legacy of the bankruptcy is 10 years later. Are things better for the people who live here? Are we spending more on services that matter to Detroiters? Was the emergency manager necessary to do the things that were done 10 years ago? And what about the employees who saw their pensions, who saw their health care, in some cases, greatly diminished or taken away as a way of reconciling the finances for the city of Detroit? What are their lives like 10 years later? A little later, we're going to talk a little more about the emergency manager law at the heart of the events 10 years ago with Anna Clark of ProPublica. She is someone who has not just followed the law as it affected Detroit, but also written extensively in a book about how the emergency manager law played out in Flint, the unbelievable tragedy that unfolded in that city in the wake of the use of that law. We'll also hear from some former city employees whose pensions and health care were affected by the bankruptcy. We also want to hear from Detroiters during this conversation. Give us a call. Let us know what's going on in your community 10 years after the bankruptcy. That might be different than what we were experiencing before. Do you see the city doing things that it didn't or couldn't do before the bankruptcy? Are you somebody who's really skeptical that things are better? Maybe things haven't changed where you are. Maybe you feel like this is just one of the things that has happened to us in Detroit, not something that has happened for us. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can always include you in the program that way. But we want to start today with some insight into what the city's finances looked like before, during, and after the bankruptcy. And to help us understand exactly what that looked like, I'm joined by someone I spent a lot of time talking to 10 years ago in the lead up to the bankruptcy and during it. Eric Scorsone is the director of Michigan State University's Extension Center for Local Government Finance and Policy. He is, in my judgment, one of the foremost experts on municipal finance here in the state of Michigan and someone who really does know intimately what happened to us here in Detroit. Eric, great to have you here on Detroit Today.
Good morning.
First of all, 10 years, boy, it does not seem like this was 10 years ago. It seems much more recent than that. But 10 years ago, you and I spent a lot of time talking about how all this came together and what happened. Let's go back to that time. Tell us what the city's finances were like 10 years ago before the bankruptcy, and whether in your judgment this was, as I said, the only viable option to set the city on a different course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the city was borrowing to pay for the borrowing it had already done, and that's a typical strategy the state uses, actually, with many cities. So the city had loaded itself up with a huge amount of debt. Some of that debt was even more problematic because it was tied into derivatives and some other financial schemes, let's call them. The city had a huge amount of fixed costs, which it just couldn't get rid of, the pension, the retiree health care. Now, those are real benefits to people, and I'm sure as you're going to talk to some folks later about how they've been impacted by those cuts. But that was the reality for city managers. They had a lot of fixed costs, and we have to remember revenues were declining rapidly. We were coming, you know, out of the Great Recession. City income taxes were way down. Property taxes were falling. And, of course, the state of Michigan had cut revenue sharing, which it gives to all cities. So there was a tsunami of events occurring. And it was really, I can remember being in City Hall in the summer of that year and looking across the street at the Renaissance Center, thinking about GM's bankruptcy just a few years earlier. Mm-hmm. And so really Detroit was hit by these huge bankruptcies within a number of years that I think exemplifies how things had gone wrong in many ways. But, you know, that's where the city was. It was really at the worst case scenario of fixed costs, high debt, and decreasing revenue.
Yeah. It was the largest municipal bankruptcy in the nation's history. But it also looked different than lots of other bankruptcies, maybe more different from any other bankruptcy, either Chapter 7, 9, or 11. Talk about how that happened and how important it was that the bankruptcy here didn't proceed as we've seen in some other cities and even in some other companies.
Right. A lot of times municipal bankruptcies take many years. They're often don't really resolve the problems ultimately, as we've seen in places like California. Most of the time, most of these bankruptcies are quite small places, or there are things like hospital districts or something like that. So this was a kind of unique situation. Often it doesn't work very well. And so there was a lot of skepticism going into this process that it could be very bad and it may not ultimately resolve all the problems. So there was a risk-taking involved in going into the bankruptcy process because it was so big and no one understood it. And you're right, like corporations, I mean, corporate bankruptcy is much more common. It's often resolved by, you know, swapping debt for stocks and things like that. And obviously you can't do that in Detroit in the same way, at least. So it was a lot of risk, a lot of skepticism. A lot of the experts thought it wouldn't work or it would take too long. So we knew going into this, we were entering a new realm. We didn't really know for sure what was going to come out of it.
And what did come out of it was really dependent on this thing we call the grand bargain, which saw almost $1 billion in external money come into the resolution of the bankruptcy, something you also don't see a whole lot. Foundations and other interests who were not parties to the bankruptcy came up with money to try to soften the blow to some creditors. Explain how that happened and whether that was the thing that, that ultimately made this work for the city.
Right, that was key, because without that, I think, yeah, it would have been more like a traditional municipal bankruptcy. And going in, we didn't realize that would happen. The judge, I have to give a lot of credit, you know, sort of looked at creating this mediation process with another judge, and that really helped bring together these other parties to bring in these resources that were not necessarily there at the beginning. And so that clearly helped resolve some of the problems of getting this bankruptcy done much faster, and probably it was not cheap, but cheaper than it would have been otherwise. And so I think the grand bargain is a unique situation. It certainly hasn't really happened in other municipal bankruptcies. It basically meant you have nonprofit foundations, you had the state of Michigan bring in something like $800 million to help resolve the crisis in a way that was less painful than it would have been otherwise. Because in a bankruptcy, as you said, I mean, there's not enough money to go around. So the question is what they call a haircut. Who's going to get the haircut? And, you know, the retirees were one of the biggest creditor groups in this situation. And so that was, you know, the haircut was targeted at them. It was targeted at some of the bondholders. And in this situation, the grand bargain helped alleviate some of that. Not all of it, of course. There was still some pain, of course, associated with this bankruptcy. But that was a unique situation. And you know, every bankruptcy is probably different. So we can't necessarily assume that would happen again.
Yeah.
Because there's talk of bankruptcy now in Highland Park. You can't assume that solution's always going to be there. And so I think we always have to be cautious that this is a not a one-off, but it's certainly unique.
Yeah. So I want to read a Twitter comment that we have already about this and have you react to it. It's something I hear a lot from Detroiters who, when they think about what happened 10 years ago and how we got past that point. Inspector Al on Twitter says, a lot of assets physically and financially were stolen, privatized. However, Detroiters are strong. Those still here are sharper. So I want to talk about the front end of that comment, this idea that essentially things were taken from Detroiters, mm-hmm. and in his view, taken unjustly during the bankruptcy as a way of stripping people here of the ability to control or own things. Did that happen? And if it did, why did it happen?
So I would characterize it. I mean, I do remember there was an article in the LA Times about basically selling some of Detroit's art to the, you know, to Los Angeles as a way to resolve this. And I think that is kind of a way to think about this. You know, there were assets essentially given off to bondholders and others to resolve their debt issues. So were they stolen? I don't know if I'd use that language. I'll let others decide if that's the right language to use. But there were absolutely assets transferred to other parties to resolve this crisis. And so, you know, however you want to characterize that, it was part of the solution. There was, you know, land and other real estate given off to some of the bondholders, investors to deal with their, you know, what they were owed. Other assets were sold. Thankfully, the Detroit Institute of Arts was not sold, but of course that was something that a lot of people were talking about at the time, mm-hmm. and thankfully that was not done. But that is true. There were assets transferred, and so I guess I would leave it to Detroiters to decide how to characterize what that was. But it was something that did happen, absolutely.
And is that something that always happens in a bankruptcy? Is that something that we should have anticipated and expected out of the process?
Yeah, of course. Every bankruptcy, the judges, the parties, the other lawyers are going to look at your assets, because that's partly how you resolve it, because you sell assets to get, you know, some of the money. And so, yeah, I mean, of course, every bankruptcy is going to look at that. Now, how much of that occurs is, of course, unique to that situation. But going into a bankruptcy, you absolutely know that the assets are going to be considered to raise funds to pay off the debt that is owed.
Yeah. I'm talking with Eric Scorsone. He is the director of Michigan State University's Extension Center for Local Government, Finance, and Policy, somebody who has paid pretty close attention to municipal finance here in the state of Michigan, as well as the bankruptcy that is 10 years old today, the Detroit bankruptcy. We're talking about that bankruptcy, how we got there, how we got through it, and what's happened in the 10 years since. We will also be talking a little later about the emergency manager law that made the bankruptcy possible, but also has created all kinds of other consequences for people in the state of Michigan. We're also going to hear a little later from the people who were impacted probably the most by the bankruptcy here in Detroit. And that's the city's pensioners, people who spent their lives working for the city of Detroit, had benefits that they had earned over that time. And those benefits had to be cut back to reconcile the debts, the massive debt that we had here in the city of Detroit. We want to hear from you as well during the conversation. Give us a call at 313-577-1019 or go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today and tell us what you make of the bankruptcy, of the 10-year anniversary of the bankruptcy. Is the city better off? Is your neighborhood better off? Your community? Are things different because the city has more money to spend providing services than it did before? It spends less sending it to creditors, spends more on direct services. How does that show up in your world? Does it show up in your world? And if it doesn't, let us know whether you think the bankruptcy was the right choice, whether it was worth the pain that we all had to endure to get through it. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number. Let's start today with Denise in Detroit. Denise, go ahead.
Hi.
Hey, Denise. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Yes, I've lived in Detroit all my life, and I want to say I've noticed this difference after the bankruptcy. I want to say that Gilbertville is booming. That's no doubt. It's beautiful downtown, but I rarely go down there because my spirit is just crushed because I live in the Harper Van Dyke area, and over here we're drowning in poverty, overwhelmed by cannabis stores, like driving another nail in a coffin. That's the only businesses that I see, which we don't own. I can look right out now. I'm looking out the window. I see all this construction work going on, but I don't see me at all. They're rebuilding houses and things. It's incredible. But we don't own them. We're renting them. When I was a girl, I used to say, when I went downtown, I used to catch the bus downtown all the time with my mom. And my neighborhood, I lived on MacDougall and Ellenwood. And it was predominantly black. And when I went downtown, I used to say, oh, this is where all the white people live. Because where I lived was solid black. But we've gone full circle. We've gone back to that. So, now I go downtown, and I'm just a guest funding the building of the city and come back home, back to the same situation 70 years ago. I also work in the school system. Our children are still being poorly educated, and I see them the next 70 years in the same place we are today. It's crushing.
Denise, I really love that you called and, of course, shared your experience. I do want to ask about whether you see services being provided in a different way after the bankruptcy than before, and whether that matters to you, or these things that you're talking about, which are much broader issues, whether you think that's more important.
Well, yes, I do think services are important, but I find it very insulting that you think I should be so excited because you fixed a few streetlights. Well, as far as I've known, all the streetlights over here have always worked anyway. The trash is still being picked up. It was before. What I do notice, though, is there's no increase in the police presence. I don't fault the police themselves, because the times they have come, they've been wonderful. But when I go downtown, nothing. The police are everywhere.
Sure.
But on Harper and Van Dyke, where I need them, I don't see them.
Yeah.
So I don't see any differences in the service.
Yeah.
So I wish they would not mention streetlights again.
Yeah. Denise, I really love that you called and shared not only your perspective, but also your passion about what's going on in our city. Thanks so much for the call. Eric, two things. One is that the conceit, I think, of the bankruptcy and the exit from bankruptcy, the plan of adjustment, the grand bargain, in part was that Detroit would be a more attractive target for investment, private investment. I think there was no question that most of that private investment would show up in downtown and places like that. At the same time, there was this promise that things would get better for Detroiters as well. And I think what Denise is saying is, or is pointing out, is there's a gap, right? We've seen a lot of one, not seeing as much of another.
Yeah, and I've heard that from other Detroiters. And, you know, I think we all knew that downtowns can always come back because they have a lot of assets that people want to be part of. So I'm not surprised that that's what's happened, this sort of bifurcation, if you will, of sort of what's going on. And I think Detroit's is going to have to do better for the neighborhoods who cannot afford. You know, some neighborhoods I know can't afford special assessments or other things to make their community better, but for a lot of communities they can't. And she makes an excellent point that, you know, downtowns are important. Probably most cities in Michigan have these complaints about, you know, the downtown gets a lot of focus, but I would agree that, you know, you've got to look at these services beyond just street lighting and traffic and trash pickup. You know, how are we getting those other services out there to get a full recovery for Detroit? And I, you know, I think that's got to be the next 10 years is really a focus on getting those things right.
Yeah. And opportunity. You know, one of the things that Denise is really pointing to is that if you live in many parts of the city, it feels as though there is no path to a better life in your neighborhood or elsewhere. And no, the bankruptcy wasn't intended directly to change that. But I think the implication was that would be a better situation for Detroiters after it was done. And too many people don't feel like that has happened. Okay, we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Eric Scorsone about the bankruptcy. We're going to add another voice to the conversation, Anna Clark, a Detroit-based reporter for ProPublica, who has also written extensively about Michigan's emergency manager law, is going to join us. A little later, we're going to hear from some pensioners in the city of Detroit about how their lives changed after the bankruptcy. We're also going to continue to hear from you, our listeners, on the phones and on social. Rick in Huntington Woods, Beverly on the west side of Detroit. We'll get to you if you want to join them. 313-577-1019 is the number. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've joined us. It is the 10-year anniversary of Detroit's decision to file municipal bankruptcy, the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. We're talking about how we got to that very low point in the city's history, how we got through that low point in the city's history, and what's happened in the 10 years since. We've got Eric Scorsone here with us. He's director of Michigan State University's Extension Center for Local Government, Finance, and Policy, somebody who has really developed an incredible expertise about municipal financing here in the state of Michigan, and also was, of course, a close payer of attention to what happened here in Detroit. I want to welcome another voice to the conversation as well. Anna Clark is a Detroit-based reporter for ProPublica, also someone who wrote a recent article about the emergency manager law that made the Detroit bankruptcy possible. Anna, welcome back to Detroit Today.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Anna, I want to start with you and have you talk about your recent piece about the emergency manager law. You know, it is still on the books, and that's kind of remarkable given the unbelievable tragedy that unfolded in the city of Flint, in large part because of the emergency manager law. At the same time, I think I'm not wrong to say I don't think any governor would go anywhere near that law at this point because of what happened in Flint. But talk about the importance of that law still being around and, of course, the consequences that cities like Flint, Flint's not the only city to experience negative consequences, just the worst, because of the emergency manager law. This was not something that most cities found beneficial in any way.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it was like a fundamental part of what happened with Detroit's bankruptcy, and also has been, you know, hugely consequential for communities and school districts all across the state of Michigan. I mean, the law is an unusually expansive system that sends like a state-appointed emergency manager into a distressed community, and they have the power that, you know, that the mayor and the city council otherwise would have, as well as additional powers besides. And, you know, of course, here in Detroit, you know, that was like a precursor to filing for bankruptcy. But, you know, in Flint, it's like it was like an unusually dramatic case of some of the dangers of a law that doesn't have, you know, of where somebody holds so much authority, and without, when there isn't any kind of like checks and balances, when there is limited transparency, when there is an extended tenure. You know, of course, Flint had like a series of four different emergency managers over 3.5 years, covering the time when all these like pivotal decisions were being made that ended up affecting the community in really devastating ways. And of course, two of those emergency managers were, you know, faced criminal charges, you know, under two different prosecution efforts that eventually were dismissed. But it's really interesting that this law, like, despite having played such a vivid role in the Flint water crisis, when even like Governor Snyder's own, you know, the commission appointed to like look into this, like cited the law as like, as a contributing factor into this. Governor Whitmer, you know, when she campaigned in 2018, was explicitly opposed to the law and was challenging it. And when the final, I remember when the final community that still had some mechanism of state oversight, you know, was restored back to its full local control, like they sent a press release, like touting it, you know, like it. And when reaching out to them for this like recent story about emergency management, you know, like folks, you know, are in the current administration seemed, you know, real clear on like trying to associate it with the previous administration, you know, like Governor Snyder's emergency manager law. But yeah, I mean, like the Democrats do have, you know, a lot of the like strongest critics like now have authority, but the law has, you know, has remained on the books. It is unchanged in any way. There have been a number of attempts to modify it, if not repeal it, over the years. One of which at least is pending right now. But like to date, it's the same as it was, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah. So Eric, I want to talk about your sense of the law and whether it's effective and how it could be changed. But I want to put it in a little bit of context. I have always interpreted the emergency manager law as essentially a vehicle for restricting what the state's ability is to manage or to intervene in local finances. And the reason I say that is because in the form of government we have, cities don't really exist in state constitutional structure. It is the state that is responsible for all of the money and all of the borrowing that cities undertake. If you didn't have an emergency manager law, essentially the only law that would control that relationship would be the Cities Act of I can't think of what I think it's 1911 that would allow the state to take over anything at any time and do anything. And so the idea of getting rid of the emergency manager law, I don't know. Clearly, the law we have is problematic and has led to really problematic consequences. At the same time, we do need a way to regulate the way the state and cities interact. And I'm not maybe explaining that in the best way, but I would love for you to try to clear that up for our listeners.
Sure. So, yeah, that's absolutely right. The state is a sovereign entity. Local governments are not. And so basically, so for example, in the 19th century, a lot of states would literally eliminate local governments. For example, the city of Memphis was shut down completely because of a plague that wiped out half the city's population in the late 19th century. The city was just gone. And then it was recreated later. That's not uncommon. Like other states allow things, like Montana allows you to shut down a city if it's too small. So this is not unusual, but yeah, we have to put it in context. Mm-hmm. What is true is Michigan's law is the most kind of draconian in the nation. Mm-hmm. It allows you to do things that generally you can in other states. I do also want to separate bankruptcy from emergency managers. There are many states that allow you to file bankruptcy that don't have an emergency manager law at all. And so we have to just separate the two things. The law, whether the law is effective or not is a very complex question, I think, actually. But I would argue we don't need it. At the end of the day, we just don't need it. We have a whole series of laws that protect the finances of local governments. We need to use those laws better, in my opinion. They're designed to protect us. They didn't work in Detroit. They, quite frankly, didn't work in Highland Park, the most recent situation we're facing. So we need to make those laws stronger. I think, you know, an NYU law professor wrote an article called Dictatorships for Democracy, and mm-hmm. he was actually right, and mm-hmm. he was a supporter of the law. Mm-hmm. But he's right in the sense that, look, the law is premised on the notion that the problem is local officials,
right.
basically.
Right.
And I would argue that's only at best partially true. I'm not going to say it's not true at all. But the fact is the state of Michigan creates a very negative environment for cities. We've actually measured this. Michigan almost always ranks in the bottom five of states as far as how we treat local government. So if we fix that, we probably don't need emergency managers right. that much. Other cities don't need these things. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? So, like, I think
other states do a better job of investing
exactly.
in municipalities.
Right.
And we do a terrible job here.
Right. I mean, other northern states, I'm not talking about states that are growing. I'm talking about Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. I mean, so these are not states like, you know, Texas or Florida. So I just think we have to think about the whole system. I think EM law has to be looked in context of everything else. I know that's a complex story, but I just think, and I think Detroit's story with the EM and bankruptcy, we should probably separate the two and talk, you know, because really the bankruptcy is a separate process in many ways.
Yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. I do want to now get to some of the voices of the people who saw their pensions reduced or taken away, healthcare benefits altered because of the bankruptcy. William Davis is president of the Detroit Active and Retired Employee Association. He retired in 2012 from the city of Detroit. William, welcome to Detroit Today.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
Yeah. So give me a sense of what you feel about what we did 10 years ago here in the city of Detroit, declaring bankruptcy, how we got out of that bankruptcy, what it did to retirees. What does that look like for you and the people you work with?
Well, I would start off by saying that I disagree with part of what you were saying in that I think that the bankruptcy was not needed. I think the bankruptcy could have been avoided. I think there was already mechanisms set in place where the city unions had already made, offered them a plan with Mayor Bean where they could have cut costs drastically, especially health care costs and other things. But the governor did not want Mayor Bean to do that. And at that time, the city of Detroit was up under a consent decree, which limited some of the stuff that possibly could happen. Also, as it relates to the bankruptcy, you know, it's been good and bad in some ways, in that it's good that the city of Detroit has a vibrant downtown and a more a stronger economic base. But it is all basically on the back of the bank of the city of Detroit retirees, you know, because our health care cost was a big factor, mm-hmm. and I can understand that. But, you know, like the pension cuts, the cost of living retroactively taken back, and an annuity clawback, which is killing, I mean, literally killing city retirees, especially with inflation. Mm-hmm. In fact, do you know that over 2,000 city retirees have died since the bankruptcy?
Wow.
You know that just since 2018, over 1,050 have died. You know, some of that is probably also due to, you know, the pandemic. You know, don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But, you know, actually more retirees have died up under the current administration than at any other time, even during World War II.
Wow. So William, I would love to hear more about how you or the people that you work with just make do. How do you make ends meet when the thing that you have counted on being there your entire life is gone or altered? What are the kinds of choices you find yourself having to make?
Well, you know, initially when the bankruptcy started, I had two sons, you know, I still have two sons, but one was in high school and one was in college going to Michigan State. My oldest son stopped going to Michigan State, even though I encouraged him to, because, you know, he thought that it was a hard financial burden on the family, especially, you know, not just the pension cut, but, you know, losing health care because they were still being carried on my health care. And, you know, after 34 years of working for the water department, especially at the wastewater treatment plant, well, the first thing they gave you was a shovel when you first came in. Mm-hmm. They were shoveling something else on us that was worse. You know, so it adversely affected my family, my standard of living, you know, just, you know, and also, you know, it was a way that generational wealth for many retirees was stripped. You know, right. And that we had next to nothing to pass on. I think that's one of the reasons, if you look at, you know, what's been going on, you know, since the bankruptcy, number of black owned family homes, that, you know, ownership has dropped drastically. In fact, the number of blacks inside the city of Detroit has dropped drastically, more so than at any other time.
Yeah. William, I really appreciate you calling and being part of the program today. And, of course, wish you the best of luck with, you know, the consequences of the bankruptcy. And, of course, to all of your members as well. Thanks so much for calling in.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Okay, we are going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue talking with Eric Scorsone and Anna Clark about the bankruptcy 10 years later. We'll also continue to hear from you on the phones and on social. If you want to join the show and let us know what you make of Detroit and Detroit's fate 10 years after the bankruptcy, 313-577-1019 is the number. That's 313-577-1019. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
For news that impacts your community,
music that moves your soul,
and conversations that matter,
WDET,
Detroit's NPR station.
This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. Stephen Henderson, and thanks for joining us 10 years today. Since Detroit declared the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history, we're talking about that bankruptcy, how we got there, how we got through it, and what's happened in the 10 years since. We've got two great guests with us who have paid lots of attention not only to what happened here in Detroit, but also what's happened in other jurisdictions with municipal finance and the state's emergency manager, Laura. Eric Scorsone is the director of Michigan State University's Extension Center for Local Government, Finance, and Policy. Anna Clark is a Detroit-based reporter for ProPublica. We also want to hear from you on the phones and on social, 313-577-1019. 1019 is the number. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today. I want to go to a particular caller here with a particular expertise on this. The judge, Honorable Wendy Baxter, who is the judge who wrote the opinion striking down the emergency manager law, the original emergency manager law. Judge Baxter, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. Did I get that right? That my memory is not as good as it used to be, that you did write the opinion striking the original emergency manager law. Is that right?
I wrote the opinion in Detroit Public Schools Board against Robert Bob, the emergency financial manager.
That's right. Okay.
Because that was the state of the law at that moment.
Right. Okay. That's right. See, your memory's better than mine, obviously. But go ahead. What do you want to add to the conversation here?
Well, I was told that they took my opinion to the legislative financial analyst and couldn't shoot any holes in it, so they changed the law to the emergency manager instead of
financial manager.
And that was a quirk in my opinion because I decided that the school board was still in charge of curriculum according to all the statutes that govern schools in Michigan. But they were definitely in charge of the money. Nothing I could say about that part of the lawsuit. But the board was still in charge, and it meant a lot to the locals. Because this was our school district,
mm-hmm.
we wanted to have a curriculum that taught things that were important to the locals, and it meant a lot to the community.
Yeah. Judge Baxter, I'm really glad you called and reminded us of that. It's an important data point because it's not the only time, in fact, that the state went back and tried to change the law to get around either a court ruling or public sentiment about how this was all working. In your case, this was the switch from an EFM to a broader law that gave emergency managers more power, stripped the limitation of their work to financial matters. And then again, later, after voters said they didn't want an emergency manager law at all, the state went back, reframed it, and then passed it, of course, with a provision that prevented the public from having a say about it. So, I mean, again, this tension about the law is in part about the way in which state officials have pursued this kind of oversight over cities.
And may I just add that this is part of a total attack on democracy because it is another way to usurp the rights of the voters.
Sure.
And have their designs and wishes not be the governing source.
Yeah, yeah. Judge Baxter, I really do appreciate the call and the comments. Anna Clark, I'm going to go to you for a reaction to what the judge is saying.
Well, I think it's, first of all, I love that she called in. I think that really gets at the core element of a lot of skepticism and resistance, to the law, which is that it does cut against the voting rights and equal protection concerns, right? And it's interesting too to remember that Detroit's, that at the time that the city had an emergency manager in charge of its of City Hall, they also simultaneously that was overlapping with the school district's, long journey with state oversight and emergency managers at the same time. And it does seem like the law is kind of premised on the idea that the disinvestment in that community is something that can be solved by just having the right person, quote unquote, the right person, come in and have all the authority, and they can just clear up, all the issues, and then sign off and then like move on, mm-hmm. As opposed to like looking at like the larger picture of the of what are the causes of disinvestment, you know, in these communities. And also just because, just to, not to put too fine a point on it too, it's like there's a lot of communities that have struggled throughout Michigan in a number of ways. But it's majority Black communities that have been especially affected mm-hmm. by emergency managers too, which makes these like voting rights and equal protection, you know, concerns even more glaring. And you know, like people have like, you know, resisted in a lot of different ways, like through lawsuits and through like a lot of the organizing, you know, that happened among community groups, you know, throughout all of this. And I think like when it comes down to it, then as now, like people just want to have, people want to have agency in their own communities. Mm-hmm. like they, people deserve the like, city services. People deserve, you know, like safety and all these like, issues that were coming into play at the time of Detroit's experience with emergency management and bankruptcy. But, you know, they also like fundamentally like want and deserve like, the ability to fully participate in their future.
Eric?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think the law, I mean, a couple observations, I guess. I think the judge, you know, that's a great point the judge made. You know, the going to an EM meant the EM had full power over the city versus the EFM, which was the old law, which actually the old law was in place for like almost 20 years and not used that often. I think it was used once or twice. Mm-hmm. I mean, I first learned about it in 2005. I think it really, nobody even knew about it at that point, really.
They used it in Benton Harbor, I believe, in the early 2000s, right. As that city was first struggling with finance.
Right.
They did it, and then they had to do it again.
Right, and they did it in Flint in the early 2000s. In fact, some of the people involved in Flint were involved again in 2012. And, yeah, I think it's interesting. It's a law that definitely premised on the idea that local officials are just out of control. They have to be taken in. I will be honest, as an economist, we are trained to be sort of cold-hearted and efficient. and I didn't realize it's taken lawyers and political scientists to kind of get me around to thinking about the due process, equal protection. And I'm much more cognizant now of those issues and how important they are. And I would agree, the law's premises are flawed, and I think there are other ways to do what we need to do. If there was a true crisis where a city could not pay, let's say, the police, and the police weren't going to show up for work, I think the state could step in and do things without an EM to make that thing right and then figure out why this happened. I just think there's other laws already in place. We just need to strengthen those laws, and we don't need an EM. Yeah. We can do this in other ways.
Well, and as Anna pointed out, you've got a Democratic majority in Lansing in both houses of the legislature and in the governor's office. This is maybe the opportunity, if they wanted, to be able to sit down and think this through in exactly the way that that you're talking about there. Again, Judge Baxter, really appreciate that you called in to the show. Let's go next to George Orzek, who is part of the Detroit Fire Department. George, we've only got a couple minutes left, and I apologize for getting you on so late, but I do want to get your perspective on 10 years after the bankruptcy. What's going on? What's going on with the folks you work with?
Oh, good morning. Thank you.
Go ahead, George.
I don't work with them anymore. I do still sit on the pension board as a fire department retirees representative.
Mm-hmm.
And still battling the city and trying to fund a pension system that received no money from the city. And in the bankruptcy, they chose to eliminate the public safety unions from negotiating any kind of benefit. So I retired in 2015 after the Eighth Amendment Plan of Adjustment was passed. And for the next 10 years, there was no benefits. They took away a cost of living. But in my time while I was chairman of the system, back when the bankruptcy started, there was once they wanted to take the cost of living away, I tried to get a program to work the cost of living back.
Mm-hmm.
through earnings, through the percentage funding of the pension system. And lo and behold, once the 10 years is over, the mayor now, Mayor Duggan and his lawyer, chose not to fund the plan according to the way our actuaries planned it.
The long and short of it is you're still fighting to make sure that your members get what they deserve 10 years after
right.
all this. Yeah.
And the most drastic cut is the healthcare.
Sure. Yeah. George, I don't mean to cut you off, but we are out of time. I really appreciate you calling in, and to everybody who called in to participate. It was a really important part of this discussion. Thanks so much for being here. Anna Clark, Eric Scorsone, of course, great to have both of you here as well. That's going to do it for us today. Come back tomorrow, and we're going to look at the price of technology and innovation and ways we can improve in these spaces. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.